Hello and welcome to QSO. It's all about ham radio. And this week, our guest, Scott Baxter, N4SB. Don't touch that dial. This guy is going to have you riveted to your seat. One of the most interesting radio guys I have ever met. Radio engineer, commercial radio engineer, amateur radio operator, now working in the cell phone industry. And you know what? We didn't even get a chance to talk about that. So, ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, don't touch that dial because you'll miss it. Scott Baxter, N4SB on QSO. Our guest is Scott Baxter, N4SB. What a set of call sign. N4SB. That's a classic amateur radio call sign, if I've ever heard one. Well, how are you doing, sir?
Well, I am doing just fine, Ted, and I appreciate the chance to have a QSO with you on the radio. So I've been looking forward to this, and I've enjoyed so many of your episodes, and it's great to have a chance to share my story, too.
Well, I have to tell this. The funny story about Scott Baxter is I was working at a radio station out in, I guess it would have been Brentwood, licensed to Brentwood. It was more like Franklin. And I kept hearing the name, Scott Baxter this and Scott Baxter that. And, you know, and I was like, I wonder about this Scott Baxter guy, you know. And so anyways, there was a directional ray out there. And I was trying to get the thing straightened out. I was trying to figure out what was wrong with it. And I try as I may, there was one tower in this array that had to go negative. And that was hard as all get out to make it happen. And then when you did get it, it was still off, you know. And it was like, I don't know by how many degrees, but it was, 10, 15, 20 degrees. I can't remember now. It's been so long ago. And I worked and worked and worked and worked. And I finally just gave up. And I said, this is just absolutely crazy. You know, I don't know why it won't work. I can't figure it out. So I talked to Gary Brown and all these other people. And then finally, down the road, I had a conversation with you on the phone. And you said, well, Ted, that tower is in the wrong place. You can't tune it to where it's supposed to be. And I thought, boy, do I wish I would have met Scott Baxter earlier on, is what I was thinking. But amongst the broadcast community, I guess what I would say is your name has been very well circulated, well respected. And, you're one of those folks that's kind of legendary. You hear Scott Baxter stories. Now, they're not bad. They're just stories about engineering things that's happened and something that you did and all that kind of stuff. And much like you would hear stories about the name has just left me. The engineer at WSM, the guy that had been there so long that said Nestortion.
I'm sorry. I'm having a senior moment, too.
Isn't that terrible?
It'll come to me in a second. But what I would interject, though, you can't imagine how many people I send a check to every month just to keep my name good out there. And that's what you're hearing, not necessarily reality. But I do remember that tower, that array down in Franklin. I'm thinking of the one you're thinking of. It was actually, I believe, what used to be WIZO, a nighttime array. And it was down beside the sewage treatment plant down there. And I remember that originally we hired a surveyor to come down and position all the towers exactly. And the engineer, who will remain nameless, it wasn't me, but he's from out of state, and that's all I'll say, lest somebody get a clue and finally track it down. But his intentions were good, but he decided that what he would do is just pace off the right number of steps if we're going to move the array about 60 feet. So he was going to pace off from each tower in the right direction about 60 paces, and that was where they were going to put the towers. So as you can imagine, in a big field of grass, walking, pacing, you're not really accurate on the direction you're pacing, and you're not really accurate on the distance when you're pacing. And so first thing I noticed when they had built it and I came down to tend it is that it was a parallelogram. And, you know, normally you would see four towers and they would be in a line viewed from one faraway location, and you go around to the other side of the road, they should be in a line from that location, both sides of the parallelogram. And these weren't. Well, you can see it with the naked eye. It was a problem. So I had to go back and redesign the pattern on that. It had several pretty deep protections for distant stations. And fortunately, by manipulating phase and current, I was able to get the, at least on paper, get the thing in. But it was never quite what it was intended to be. And we had hoped to file for a power increase later on, but unfortunately, it lost the control, really, the pattern to do that.
But that station originally, that station originally was not WIZO. It was Biff Colley put it on. They called it Car 56. That was
okay. Well, that that's the different one. WIZO was on 1380. And
right.
I think it's Hispanic now. But the other one was on 560, and it had a four-tower array, no nighttime operation. But there's a station on in Paducah on 550. And, of course, as you can imagine, up Paducah is in very good, rich soil, and that whole area of the state has a ground conductivity of 8 on the SCC map, and it's really even a little bit better in a lot of that coastal Mississippi bottomland. But it turns out that it was possible to have a very, very, very tightly constrained pattern. It was broad to the east. It went from almost north to almost south, really strong on the east side, and then virtually nothing off the backside. And it was a real devil of a problem to try to find that much land available in Brentwood. And even back in those days, Brentwood wasn't quite the the affluent bedroom community that is today. So that one was a very difficult pattern. It was very high Q, and I'm surprised that that we were able to get the thing in. It met all the requirements. I'm not sure it actually radiated as much as it was supposed to. There was so much power being exchanged from tower to tower to tower that losses in the feed circuits were pretty significant. I don't know if it radiated more than 60 or 70% of what was fed into it.
Well, you know, here's an interesting story. The gentleman who I was trying to think of was Everett Lawson.
Yes.
He was the transmitter engineer over at WSM AM. And I used to go visit with him, and for some reason, he was really fascinated with this 560 station. And I'll tell you who else was, too, and that was Grant Turner at WSM. Now, why? I don't know. But anyways, I went over to see Everett, and we were talking, and I says, I told him all the problems I was having with it. And I went over there, and the first thing he said to me, what I had done is I took one of the doggone tuning boxes over there. I just picked it up off the ground. I mean, it was big old tall legs, and disconnected everything and took it over there. And I said, I want you to look at this. Do you see any gross errors or anything? He said, well, you've got to have a hole in the bottom and run that strap up through that hole. He said, otherwise, that RF can't get in or out. And I thought, now, wait a minute. I thought, I think he's handing me a snipe bag and telling me to go wait in the woods for the snipe, So, and he seemed dead serious about this, So I thought, well, if it's strapped to the bottom of the tuning box, and it's copper to copper, so to speak, it's got to work. I mean, and he said, oh, no, you're going to have to cut. He said, if you look, all these out, any ones you see, they'll have slots across the bottom and, they're an inch wide and the copper goes up inside. I'm like, well,
yeah.
I've seen that. Yeah, I know. He said, but it'll work just fine. Just cut you a hole. He said, make it as big as you want it. And he said, run your copper up through there. He said, you may want to put some screen in to keep the wasps out, And I thought, well, I went back and I was skeptical. I really was. I thought, man, this fella has seen me coming and he's fixing to have some fun. So I went and drilled holes in every one of those tuning boxes and brought that copper strap up through the hole. And by God, he was right. It changed everything. It acted completely different. And I thought to myself, I said, self. Yeah, it's amazing, though, the things that, that's not in the NAB and engineering handbook anywhere. You can't find that in that book anywhere. You know, and
it's real. I mean, though, that's what's happening is when you get to very, very low base impedances and you have very high circulating currents, then the resistance going through some single bolted connection from strap outside up through the box into a strap inside can have enough resistance that it makes it very difficult to get things tuned properly. And so, you know, in many tuning units, you know, in more normal length towers, it wouldn't matter quite as much. But when you're on a very wild impedance array, and especially one with a negative tower or a tower that floats around between a little bit positive and a little bit negative on impedance, then that's enough to make a big difference in things. So he was dead on the money, and, you know, he is much missed. He was, for many years, he was the chief engineer over WLAC. And back during that time, I think Watt Hairston took quite a liking to him. And when he came over to WSM, same thing. But he was beloved because he always shot from the hip and spoke from the heart. And your story about Nestortion, I'll let you tell it because it's pretty colorful. But it was a reference basically to how much of a certain pollutant would you want in your coffee.
Oh, yeah.
It made the point very well. You probably remember that one.
Wow. You know, what a story. I mean, what a story about a transmitter engineer. You know, and there he was, and he was right in that, of course, programming people and even management people today. I asked a question the other day. I was just asking. I thought, why is it that owners of radio stations always pick someone that knows so little and they trust them explicitly? Somebody comes along that's well studied and knows what they're talking about, and when you tell them something, they just roll their eyes at you. Why is that?
Well, I think that probably the broadcast industry is one of the most free-form and kind of unstructured arrangements. You know, we've come a long way now. This transition of the last few years where the multiple ownership rules have been pretty much thrown aside, and now most broadcast stations are part of big institutional holding companies, really. Back in the earlier days, it was really, for the most part, family-owned stations or small businesses where there were just a few partners. And back in those days, really there weren't a lot of standards for and a lot of knowledge of RF and the transmitting technologies. And so it was pretty much just a do you like the guy or do you not decision, usually when hiring the technical staff. And in most places, the morning DJ would be the chief engineer also. And so, you know, in those days, there were some people who excelled in one thing and some people who excelled in something else. And in a lot of the stations, there wasn't any real good in-house technical guidance. So there have been a lot of stories, and, you know, probably you couldn't find in any other industry as many stories that are just such convoluted, fascinating cases of humor as in the broadcast industry. There is so much to tell back in those days. And I remembered, I don't think of myself as an old person, but I was born at a very early age in 1950. And when I was about, I guess I was just driving at the age of 16, I was working at WSM at the TV transmitter back then, and I went driving around one time to just take pictures of all the transmitters that I would be allowed to visit around town. And I remember I was welcomed very warmly in just about every place and allowed to make pictures of everything. I remember old Bill Orm down at WAGG in Franklin, and I came in. He had an old Gates transmitter, 1 kilowatt. And I came in and asked the receptionist in the front if it would be okay for me to come and just take pictures of the transmitter. And he came shouting out of his office and said, "What kind of a fool wants to take pictures of transmitters?"
Oh, gosh.
We visited for about 5 or 10 minutes then, and he still thought I was an idiot, but he said, "Well, come on in." And those were different days in broadcasting, and for those of us who were back there, it was a wonderful thing, and it was closer to the cutting edge than it is today.
Oh, see now, AGG, that was the Franklin, was it 950?
950.
Yeah, and that's the Jim Hayes' station today.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah,
yes,
and
I'm not sure what the ownership is. I think Jim is still in it. They're located there on Mallory Station Road, just about 500 feet east of the railroad crossing, And so, of course, that whole area has gone up. I doubt that the station is worth as much as the land it sits on.
Oh, that's what I was told. But my son Matt, the fella that works for Dave Ramsey as chief engineer, he does. He works with Jim on the streaming. I think he has a server that runs their streaming, and I don't know, maybe even their website. I'm not sure, but I know he goes over there and helps out once in a while. And so we were out there. This has been, I don't know, several months ago, and we went in, and that is one of the neatest, well put together AM radio stations I've laid eyes on. And it only goes to show what you can do with an AM if you really are working at it. And today when people say, well, AM's all washed up, you can't do nothing with it, I say, you know what? You're lazy, okay? You're wanting somebody to hand you something. And if you go out, if you put programming on the air that's local and you cater to the local community, you can do okay with an AM station today. You know, there's really no excuse for some of the stuff I hear. But you look at these people that run these things. They're not like Jim Hayes. Jim Hayes is consistent. You know, he's a businessman, and he knows what he's doing. And then you look across town at another radio station, and it's like a zoo, you know. And there's no wonder that they're broke and it doesn't work, you know. So, but anyways, that's my soapbox. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to QSO. Our guest today, Scott Baxter. We'll be back with him right after this. How about a shortwave radio you can hold in the palm of your hand? How about a shortwave radio that's no bigger than a pack of cigarettes? And yet, so sensitive and so selective, it will blow your mind. I'm talking about the SkyWave. The SkyWave radio from Sea Crane. You need to go to the Sea Crane website, seacrane.com, and check out the SkyWave. I've not seen anything like this radio. I've looked at every kind of shortwave radio there is. This thing is a mind blow. It really is. It's based around some sort of a DSP chip, I guess I want to say. And, buddy, when it locks into a signal, it locks in. I'm listening to WTWW on this thing, and I'm just having my mind blown. Go check this thing out. If you don't have one, you need one. If you're a shortwave radio listener and a shortwave fan, you have to have a SkyWave, especially with Art Bell coming back to radio via shortwave on WTWW. Now, if you'll call the Sea Crane Company and order a SkyWave mentioning WTWW, you will get the portable, retractable wire antenna absolutely free for mentioning WTWW. So go to their website, seacrane.com. Here at QSO, we hear success story after success story. We hear excited people telling us they just got their ticket using Ham Test Online. That's right. This is the easiest, most concise, as well as fastest method to get that ticket in your hand. Ham Test Online. No thick books to read, no DVDs, no CDs to wade through, no studying for hours and hours and then forgetting what you studied, and no irrelevant information that you have to wade through in order to get to the things that are really on the test. Ham Test Online. Now, if you've already upgraded to Extra Class and you no longer need the services of Ham Test Online, we want you to think about this. Ham it forward. That's right. Ham it forward. Now, what is that? There's a lot of folks out there that would like to Elmer someone into the hobby, but you're not quite sure how to do it. Don't know if you could really tackle the project. There's folks out there that would like to teach a class of maybe three or four people or maybe larger. But you see that as a real undertaking. Don't know if you can quite handle that. Working with someone and getting them their ham ticket is one of the most satisfying things that you could do as a radio amateur and promote this hobby, moving it forward with new blood. That's why we have Ham It Forward. Now, this is a cooperative effort from Amateur Radio Roundtable, the QSO radio show, and the folks at Ham Test Online. All you have to do is get a subscription for a new prospective ham, and then just follow through with them a little bit. and let HamTest Online take them through the steps and get their ticket painlessly, easy, and fun. Keep this in mind. It's a new program. We're calling it Ham It Forward. And we'd love for you to participate in this. Everybody knows someone that they would love to get into the hobby. Give a gift. Give the gift of the ham radio, amateur radio hobby by Ham It Forward. Go to hamtestonline.com. That's hamtestonline.com. Or look on the QSOradioshow.com website. Is it possible that a coffee roaster who has been blind from birth could make the best tasting coffee in the world? Well, I'm here to tell you that not only is it possible, but it's true. If you would like the most delightful, rich cup of coffee you have ever drank in your life, I'd like to invite you to visit the website of The Unseen Bean. That's The Unseen Bean, UNSEENBEAN, TheUnseenBean.com. Jerry Leary, amateur radio operator, shortwave listener, he is the owner of The Unseen Bean, one of the country's few blind coffee roasters. You will love his coffee. We want to invite you once again, go to his website, and that's TheUnseenBean.com. That's TheUnseenBean.com. Here at the QSO Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website, simply QSORadioShow.com. That's QSORadioShow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there and other information. But go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website. It's simply QSORadioShow.com and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening. N4SB is our guest, Scott Baxter. So let's get back to Scott. But our Everett Lawson story. We haven't told the Everett Lawson story. We've got to tell that. First, we have to set it up. Everett was like a lighthouse keeper, okay? And when you went over to WSM, you went into that white building that had that rotating beacon on the top. Yeah, and you went inside and you saw that spiral staircase going downstairs. It was like stepping into a lighthouse. Am I right?
Yes, you are.
I expected him to grab a lantern, you know, and escort you down to the basement, you know. But
was it the stairway to heaven or the stairway to hell? We always debated that.
Well, his favorite thing was that metal shop that he had. He had a shop downstairs that had lathes and everything out of the sun. He could make anything.
Oh, yeah.
He could duplicate any radio part out of anything. And every time I go over there, he'd say, let me show you what I'm working on now, you know. And here we go downstairs, and there'd be this whole thing. Now, the way this story was told to me, and I want you to jump in and correct me or guide me here, but there was quite a discussion on audio processing going on. And this involved the Opry as well as WSM AM. And I don't know what happened here. I think I swallowed some steel wool or something. Anyways, he was opposed to that. He didn't like a lot of audio processing. I mean, I think he would permit a gain writing device, but I don't think he liked all this positive peak extension and clipping and things that are done to the AM signals nowadays. He just didn't go for that. He wanted fidelity and dynamic range and all those things. So from what I understand, they wanted to put processing on WSM, try to make it louder or something. And the program director, and I don't know who else, went out to meet with him and to talk to him and to try to convince him to put some processing on the station. And so when he got out there, they started talking, and he says, well, you know, when you start doing that, you start adding distortion, except he said distortion, and you start adding distortion to the signal. And so this hotshot program director, now am I right so far? Am I getting down the road the right way?
Yes, you are. Now, I think he had that view at WSM, but I heard the story before he went to WSM that it happened at WLAC AM in Nashville, where he was chief engineer for a long, long time before WSM. But it's just as you're describing, hotshot program director came in, and the general manager was kind of in his pocket and said, you know, we just need to be louder. And so I thought that he made a pretty effective analogy here. I don't know whether it's better for you to tell it or me to tell it.
Oh, well.
But go ahead.
Well, go right ahead. It's not inappropriate in any way, shape, or form. But, hey, I'm glad you corrected me, because I was told that it happened at WSM. But see, if you heard it before he went over there, then obviously it was a WLAC story.
Well, now I'm pretty sure that he was an advocate of keeping it clean over at WSM too. So it's probably correct either way you tell it. But the first episode that I've heard and heard before he made the transition was over at WLAC, and basically he had, you know, reasoned with him and reasoned with him and reasoned with him, and the argument wasn't really going his way, and so he finally said, well, how many drops of pee would you like in your coffee?
Yeah. Well, see, now what I was told is that the program director spoke up and asked him and said, well, Everett, how much distortion could we tolerate in the signal?
Right.
You know, and then he said, well, you hold your coffee cup out there and let me start peeing in it, and you just tell me when to quit. And now that's the way I was told the story. And you know what? It fits him to a T. I mean, it really does.
Yeah.
And there are several other stories when I go out there, he'd start saying, well, now guess what the geniuses are doing now, you know? And I think about that. I think back on that. But you know what's cool is I remember when I was a kid, in Detroit, Michigan, or the Detroit metropolitan area, my dad would tune in WSM on his transistor radio, little Emerson 888, and he would have it on the picnic table in the backyard, and here would be the Grand Ole Opry. Well, as I got a little older, I was working at a country radio station down in Toledo, and I would tune in, and I would listen to WSM and the Opry on Saturday nights and on Sunday nights, or actually Friday nights and Saturday nights, because they had, at one point in time, they had two shows on Friday night, and they had two on Saturday night. And then Ralph Emery occupied a spot in the evenings on WSM, and I've heard people argue with me, say, oh, no, but I listened. I know. He was on the air.
He was there.
And there was a fella, they were at the Channel 4 television site. It's where the studios were. And I went over to see him one time. I think it was like the second country radio seminar I was here. And there was a fellow with him that was kind of operating as his PR guy, you know. And I think the guy, there's a bald-headed fellow by the name of John Riggs. I don't know if you ever heard of that guy or...
No, don't think I know him. I think I've heard the name, but I...
He's still around. He's a songwriter. But I remember going up into the studio, and I was amazed that the studio was nothing to look at. I mean, it was pretty basic. I mean, it was a lot worse off than the Detroit stations that I had worked at, you know. So, but I guess what I'm saying is I remember the audio on WSM when I was a kid in Detroit listening on a car radio. That audio was just as clear and just as pristine. And when the Opry came on, you know, it really sounded good, you know. And then as the years went by, when you tune in the Opry or WSM, you know, it sounded like it had been squashed by a large elephant, you know. I mean, just had that.
Real muddy.
Yeah, and right in your face. Just, you know, and on AM radio, and I know Everett proved this point on AM radio, the more you process AM, the worse it sounds. I mean, there's no trade-off for it. You start compressing, running heavy AGC, even doing multi-band. You know, I watched Ed Budaba in Detroit, who was the chief engineer for CKLW. And I was just a young guy, and I was with him. Matter of fact, I used to hang out with him out at the Harrell transmitter site. And he said, we want to process this thing. He said, but we got to make it sound like it's not processed. And he was the one that developed the very, very first multi-band audio processor.
That's where Orban got the idea?
Oh, yeah, that's where everybody got the idea. Ed was the first one. He was working for Bill Drake, and he come up with this idea of three separate, and I don't know if the LA3s, LA4s, I don't remember what they were, but there were the three LA units were there. He had devised his own crossover network and then combined them and then went into a limiter, but it was not all that aggressive. In other words, he wasn't. But he did, on the end of it, he did do positive peak extension. And there's a video that's out, The Rise and Fall of the Big 8, if you have a chance to watch it. He talks about how they almost blew up the original Gates transmitter. You know, or no, it was an RCA. It was an RCA 50. What was the designation? MH, what was it?
Was those Ampliphase? Was that back in the Ampliphase days?
Or yeah, but I don't. It wasn't an Ampliphase. It was just a huge 50-kilowatt RCA. I don't believe it was Ampliphase, but boy, it was big. That thing was like a monster, and it couldn't. It would not do. It would not do much over 80% negative peaks, or it would. Yeah. There would be all sorts of fireworks inside. It was pretty crazy, you know. But they
and
replaced
a lot of distortion too.
Yeah, they replaced it. No, oddly enough, that thing. The way he ran it, really. I mean, CKLW was famous for their clean boom thump type audio, but then that was after he had put this multiband rig in, and I remember that very well, because we, after he had it in, we took off and went over the bridge and drove all over the Detroit area. Boy, it sounded good. It made it the competitor WKNR Kaner 13 sound like it was coming out of a box. You know, it had that single band, you know, when the bass drum would hit, the cymbals would disappear, you know. Anyways, enough of this. Let me ask you, how did you ever start or get into broadcast engineering?
Well, when I was, I guess I would have been about 12 or 13, couldn't drive yet. And I was a ham at that point, got my novice at the age of 11. I was WN4BXI, and next year I got my general and became WA4BXI. But still in the summers, to have something to do, I used to ride my bicycle a lot. And I'd get friends from school to go with me on all-day trips sometimes, and sometimes I'd just go by myself. But riding down the hard-packed, dirt, not-yet-paved roadbed of I-65, one time I was coming a big loop from my home in Nashville near Lipscomb University, driving down Granny White Pike and on further south, finally into Franklin. I came out of Franklin on Liberty Pike and turned back north on the I-65 dirt roadbed and rode it and rode it and rode it. And I had not seen the WSM tower before, so there it was as I was driving up from the south. First I saw it, but I get closer and closer and closer, and it kind of reminds you of a gigantic spider there with its eight legs poised. And so I had to get off and go see that. So I went and knocked at the front door, and this would have been, I guess, 1964. And Mr. Buford, the porter or janitor at the transmitter site, came to the door, and I pled my case and said, "Hi, my name is Scott Baxter, and I'm a ham radio operator, and I've always wanted to see a broadcast transmitter, and was wondering if it was possible for me to come in and take a tour." And he said, "Just a minute." And fortunately, Johnny Spillers Campbell, the chief engineer of WSM during those years, was a pretty mature man and close to retirement, but he happened to be there at that point, and he came in and took a liking to me, and we walked around looking at stuff, and, you know, I was familiar with single sideband transmission and thought that was much more spectrally efficient than double sideband AM. And I just asked him, said, "Are you guys thinking about ever doing single sideband?" And he said, "Well, as a matter of fact, the COM single sideband system is being tested right here, right now." And so he was quite shocked that a 12-year-old would come in and ask about single sideband. And they were one of the early pioneer stations that Leonard Kahn used for his, not carrier suppressed, but just one of the sidebands suppressed systems, trying to solve the problems of monkey chatter and adjacent channel interference in AM. Of course, it never really caught on in a big way, and so it was just one of those interesting projects that kind of went by the way. But he was impressed with that and said, "Well, now, young man, when you get to be old enough to work, you come back and talk with us, and we might have a job for you." So that was a thrill to me, and sure enough, when I was 16, I came back, and they didn't need any help at the AM transmitter then, but they need, They needed somebody at the TV transmitter over on Knob Road. You mentioned the one peak of the hill where the studios are, and this, of course, was on the western peak of the same pair of hills. And so I got to work there. Revis Hobbs was the transmitter supervisor back then, and met a whole bunch of colorful folks there. Some have passed on, and some of them are still around. But it was a great environment. It was a perfect way for a 16-year-old to get you know, just a chance to apply all the radio interests they had. I was fortunate to learn a lot about TV at that point. And going back a little further, there's a side to WSN that's pretty fascinating. You mentioned the machine shop out at the AM transmitter. Way back in the early days, WSM's chief engineer, beginning just before the Second World War, was John H. DeWitt. DeWitt was a very brilliant man. During the war years, he was in the Army and was tasked with something that hadn't been done yet, to see if you could bounce radio signals off the moon and use it as a method to get secure communications over a large part of the Earth. And so he did that, and that research and that experimentation was done right there at the WSM AM transmitter, where it still stands right now. And the actual moon transmissions were done with a helical antenna and, of course, obviously tube-type equipment back in those days, and they set it up right in the middle of that circular drive at the transmitter building. And he finally, in order to have the sensitivity, they had only about a 100-watt transmitter, but in order to have the sensitivity to be able to reflect off the moon, he had to use a very narrow receiving bandwidth of about a hertz. So that meant that you couldn't see any fast pulses or anything, but the fastest data you could get would be something that turned on and off at a 1 hertz rate. So that was a fascinating event.
So you say they used a helical antenna. How big was that thing?
Well, they did it. I don't remember the exact frequency. I think it was somewhere up in the 130 megahertz range, so very close to the ham 2 meter band. And so it wasn't extremely large. I think the whole thing was something like a 10-foot length. But if you go back in the predecessor of the IEEE, the Institute of Electrical and Electronics, you go back to the Institute of Radio Engineers, the IRE, he had papers published there, and look for them around, I think the final success was somewhere right around the middle to the end of the war. So it would be in the mid-40s, early mid-40s, and I'm sure that's around somewhere. I'd love to collect that paper, but haven't gone out, haven't had the time to go look at it. There's so many things we'd like to do that we just always seem to be, it seems to be three levels below what we have to do at the moment, so it just never gets done.
Tell me about it. You know, it's, and there's so many fascinating things, so many really, really cool things that you'd like to look into, just the time. Well, just the time to do it. Well, the other thing was, as I was going to say, at one point in time at that transmitter site, they were using FM on a different frequency. What was it, 40, 50 megahertz or something like that?
Yeah. There were two FM bands way back early on, and one was down in the 30 to 50 megahertz range. And I remember my parents growing up, this would have been about 1953, 1954, when I was just, 3 or 4 years old, just becoming aware of what was in the house. They had an old 78 RPM record changer, mono big bass speaker and woofer and some tweeters. And at that time, what was considered to be a really magnificent home radio. But it sat about the size of typical televisions that you see in the 60s. But it had numbered channels on the FM dial. I forget the lower number channels, but the ones in the current FM band went from number 200 to number 300. Now, they're still, in the FCC allocation scheme, they still refer to the frequencies as channels. But I've never seen a radio that was calibrated in channel numbers as well as frequency. So we had that back then. Also, I remember somebody I did lawn mowing for when I was 12 or 13 years old had a radio like that. But the 30 to 50 megahertz was the first frequency range that Edward Armstrong was working in. Armstrong had lined up, Armstrong had this strong belief that FM would have much higher fidelity than AM. Also, it's much less susceptible since it is a limited kind of signal, doesn't have spikes. It will be less susceptible to the transient noise that you have from lightning and thunderstorms. And so it was just better all around, a better audio pipe than AM. And so he had got several manufacturers involved and built a network of transmitters down in the 30 to 50 megahertz range to demonstrate it in many cities and so on. And his nemesis over at RCA, David Sarnoff, managed to kind of come in as a so-called friend of the commission, to the FCC, and he convinced the FCC that the frequencies that Armstrong was using were not as well suited to FM as the current band, 88 to 108 megahertz. And he wanted to get the lower frequencies so that you could have the low VHF TV channels 2, 3, and 4, and 5. And he recommended that FM be moved up to the new frequencies. And, of course, the real underlying commercial purpose was to sabotage Armstrong's efforts. Armstrong was just about to get some traction and get FM off the ground and publicly accepted. But now, in one stroke, the commission issued this order, basically following what Sarnoff had recommended, and wound up moving Armstrong to 88 to 108 megahertz, the band that we know now. So all of the transmitters were obsolete. All the receivers that people had bought, the demonstration receivers, were all obsolete. And Armstrong was basically back to the dustbin to try to start it all again. So he did, and he did ultimately prevail. He actually committed suicide before FM really caught on. But there are so many fascinating stories like that. Back in those early days, you know, we think we live in a wild and woolly time right now. It was just as wild and woolly back then. Things just didn't move as fast.
Well, you know, I had a, when I was a kid, my parents had a stand-up Stromberg-Carlson combination record player AM-FM shortwave, you know, record radio combination with the, of course, I never liked it because it only played 78s, you know, it wouldn't even accommodate a 45. But anyhow, what was real interesting was it had FM 1 and FM 2 on it. And I remember that FM 2 band went from like 40 to 60 or 40 to 50 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And of course there was never anything on it, but evidently, must be that in the Detroit area, they must have had an FM station at one time, or maybe two, operating.
And they did here in Nashville. Actually, back to our original thread just a minute ago, we were talking about WSM, and you understood that they operated something down there. Yes, they did. And they had a batwing antenna that was used for the FM station on the top of the tower. It went up another 78 feet, I think I recall. And it was connected by a transmission line all the way down the tower and into the transmitter room. I've heard many times the story that originally they were concerned about whether they had it matched correctly, but back in those days, in the late 30s, I guess it would have been, maybe the late 30s or maybe it was just the early 40s, but at any rate, there were no reflectometers and no directional couplers or anything else in a commercially available form. And so Jack DeWitt, when they were concerned about that, actually just had holes drilled in the outer conductor of the hardline transmission line down there in the basement, and they drilled holes every few inches, every 3 or 4 inches, for about a wavelength. And then you'd take a flashlight bulb with a little loop soldered on it and just look at the brightness of what the bulb picks up as you stick it in, and you could see the waves, the standing waves of that inductive coupling. I guess it would be current standing wave ratio. Today everybody talks about VSWR, voltage standing wave ratio. But that was the first measurements. Now today, in a cellular system or in broadcast system or military radar or whatever, today you'd actually use a reflectometer or a directional coupler and sweep generators. We have TDRs now, time domain reflectometers. We can do so much stuff, and normally today we talk about reflected power in terms of return loss or reflection coefficient or something a little bit more sophisticated, but we're still, especially in the amateur radio fraternity, which I'm still a happy member of, VSWR has been and probably will continue to be the popular way to express it. But there's several different ways to express it, and the commercial guys go one way, and the hams are still using VSWR, and of course, you can easily, with equations, convert from one to the other. Percentage reflected, VSWR, return loss in dB, or reflection coefficient, which is something you'd have to measure with a vector network analyzer.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to QSO. Our guest today, Scott Baxter. We'll be back with him right after this. How about a shortwave radio you can hold in the palm of your hand? How about a shortwave radio that's no bigger than a pack of cigarettes, and yet so sensitive and so selective it will blow your mind? I'm talking about the SkyWave. The SkyWave radio from Sea Crane. You need to go to the Sea Crane website, seacrane.com, and check out the SkyWave. I've not seen anything like this radio. I've looked at every kind of shortwave radio there is. This thing is a mind blow. It really is. It's based around some sort of a DSP chip, I guess I want to say. And, buddy, when it locks into a signal, it locks in. I'm listening to WTWW on this thing, and I'm just having my mind blown. Go check this thing out. If you don't have one, you need one. If you're a shortwave radio listener and a shortwave fan, you have to have a SkyWave, especially with Art Bell coming back to radio via shortwave on WTWW. Now, if you'll call the Sea Crane Company and order a SkyWave mentioning WTWW, you will get the portable, retractable wire antenna absolutely free for mentioning WTWW. So go to their website, seacrane.com. Here at QSO, we hear success story after success story. We hear excited people telling us they just got their ticket using Ham Test Online. That's right. This is the easiest, most concise, as well as fastest method to get that ticket in your hand. Ham Test Online. No thick books to read, no DVDs, no CDs to wade through, no studying for hours and hours and then forgetting what you studied, and no irrelevant information that you have to wade through in order to get to the things that are really on the test. Ham Test Online. Now, if you've already upgraded to Extra Class and you no longer need the services of Ham Test Online, we want you to think about this. Ham it forward. That's right. Ham it forward. Now, what is that? There's a lot of folks out there that would like to Elmer someone into the hobby, but you're not quite sure how to do it. Don't know if you could really tackle the project. There's folks out there that would like to teach a class of maybe three or four people or maybe larger, but you see that as a real undertaking. Don't know if you can quite handle that. Working with someone and getting them their ham ticket is one of the most satisfying things that you could do as a radio amateur and promote this hobby, moving it forward with new blood. That's why we have Ham It Forward. Now, this is a cooperative effort from Amateur Radio Roundtable, the QSO radio show, and the folks at Ham Test Online. All you have to do is get a subscription for a new prospective ham, and then just follow through with them a little bit and let Ham Test Online take them through the steps and get their ticket painlessly, easy, and fun. Keep this in mind. It's a new program. We're calling it Ham It Forward. And we'd love for you to participate in this. Everybody knows someone that they would love to get into the hobby. Give a gift. Give the gift of the ham radio, amateur radio hobby by Ham It Forward. Go to hamtestonline.com. That's hamtestonline.com. Or look on the qsoradioshow.com website.
Is it possible that a coffee roaster who has been blind from birth could make the best tasting coffee in the world? Well, I'm here to tell you that not only is it possible, but it's true. If you would like the most delightful, rich cup of coffee you have ever drank in your life, I'd like to invite you to visit the website of The Unseen Bean. That's The Unseen Bean, UNSEEN BEAN, The theunseenbean.com. Jerry Leary, amateur radio operator, shortwave listener, he is the owner of the Unseen Bean, one of the country's few blind coffee roasters. You will love his coffee. We want to invite you once again, go to his website, and that's theunseenbean.com. That's theunseenbean.com. Here at the QSO Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website, simply QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there and other information. But go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website. It's simply QSOradioshow.com and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening. N4SB is our guest, Scott Baxter. So let's get back to Scott.
But ham radio has been a great way to get familiar with radio technology. And even today, although the radio technology is pretty well cut and dried, there are still nice new technologies to try. There's spread spectrum to work with, all kinds of digital modulation. And basically, people who are in ham radio today are still at the forefront of a vast playground that borders on a very serious technology domain. Still, people who have had some ham radio experience are better prepared for what they're going to see in engineering school, and better prepared for what they're going to see out in the commercial workplace as technicians. And it also builds a kind of discipline and a kind of a respect for what it's hard to learn. And so I'm pleased. I'm happy that people are doing all the other things, hacking and all kinds of other experimentation that young people today do. But it's nice that ham radio is still a little bit more esoteric than it was, a little bit more off the beaten track. But I've seen so many people go into that and come out of that with a special, very sharpened sense that leads them on in their careers and into the very good and very useful things.
Let me back up here a little bit. We'll transgress backwards. I guess that would be a good term to use.
All right.
We'll step over some things. Let's go back to a time where Scott Baxter has just learned or heard of ham radio. Where did that happen? And who was it that brought the news to you, or how did you happen upon it?
Well, I suppose that listening to shortwave and the few shortwave signals I could hear on that elaborate home system that my parents had when I was probably 5 or 6 or 7 years old kind of at least planted the seed in my mind that that was an interesting direction to go. At first, I remember having a chemistry set when I was about in first grade, and that was fun, but I wasn't quite up to understanding the subtleties of that, and so I never really got examples or results just exactly like the book said. And so I played with batteries and wires and bulbs and things and had a lot of fun with that. I guess second grade is the time there. A friend down the street named Bill Steensland, and he still lives up in Ohio, is a dear friend. Bill was a ham, and he had just moved from novice to general, and he had an old homemade transmitter. I don't think he made it. It was by someone before, but he managed to get it inexpensively. It was about the equivalent of a Heathkit DX100. And he had an old, I think it was SX110 Hallicraft receiver. And he invited me down to his house one day. He was 4 years ahead of me in school. So when I was, a seventh grader, he was about to graduate from high school. And we both went to the same series of schools, David Lipscomb there in South Nashville. So at any rate, he's the one who probably infected me with the desire to go further into that. He had an old shortwave receiver. It worked pretty well. Had no case, and so we took a cardboard box and cut out a place for the dial and knocked some holes where the pots and tuning knob could fit through and So I listened to that, and I was just mesmerized, listened a lot. So I decided then to go and get my novice license. Five-word per minute code, it takes a lot of practice, and for an 11-year-old at that point, it took some discipline to do that. I forget whether it was the ARRL directly or whether it was one of the Nashville Ham Clubs, but one of the ARRL former directors for the Delta region, Max Arnold, W4WHN, he's been gone now for 20 years or more, but he was kind of the mentor who got me through the code. They also had technical classes, and I enjoyed that. There was a fellow named Gary Beatty. I have lost track with him, but he taught a lot of the classes. He did some broadcast work. I remember he brought in a Mica capacitor one evening, great big old transmitting Mica capacitor, I think a G3 or something, and we all marveled at how big it was, and had a rated voltage of 12 kilovolts and so on, and that just sunk the hook even deeper. So I passed my novice and got on the air, and about 9 months later, I went to take my general. And unfortunately, first time around my general, I failed the code. It was given in the old post office building in Nashville, which is now the Frist Museum of Art. And they gave the code test in a big marble-walled room on the upstairs floor, and the echoes, and that's I just couldn't quite keep up with that. So
well, that was like the FCC federal buildings. The one in Detroit was like that. The ceiling was 150 feet from the floor, and it was all marble up to where it was glass. And if you were sitting in the back of the room, you know, it was like listening to music on an old automobile spring reverb, you know, on the big oval speakers in the back, you know. I mean, it just rang. I mean, I passed the test at 13 words a minute, but I was straining because it was like, whoa. I mean, it was like, who would put someone in a place like that and expect them to be able to make heads or tails out of it, you know?
But I'll take your headphones, please.
you mentioned Gary Beatty. Oddly enough, I worked with him over at WSM, and he was on the air. I was on the air, but I never knew he was a ham. We missed that conversation.
I don't know if that's the same Gary Beatty. He was about, I'm guessing, probably 12 or 15 years older than me. That would put him up, I'm 65 now, or 60, no, 65. That would put him up at about 70, you know, late 70s, almost 80. Is that the one you're thinking of?
I don't know. I don't, probably not. This fellow wasn't that old, but there was a Gary Beatty that I worked with, and he was on the air. So, but it's probably a different fellow, you know. Maybe we didn't miss the conversation.
Gary Beatty worked at the DuPont plant in Old Hickory, Tennessee, and was kind of an industrial controls and electronics engineer back in the 60s when it was largely, mechanical timers and relays and vacuum tube electronics and all of that. But he was certainly a mentor and a motivator for a lot of people in those novice class license evenings. We'd meet at the old Red Cross building. I forget which evenings it was. I think it was either Tuesdays or Thursdays, and you get there at 7 and go home about 9. And I just lived for that. That was just the most exciting part of my life. And then, kind of like the progression that some people go through from trying maybe a drug of entry like marijuana or something, and then finally winding up with crack cocaine, I kind of started with an interest in ham radio and finally wound up in broadcasting. And then broadcasting later led me to cellular. So I guess that's the progression. But I would say there are a lot worse things to be addicted to than all the RF disciplines. It's really been a great life for me. And so I progressed through equipment. My parents were proud that I was branching out and going this way. And, of course, it was the years when we were reacting to the Russians beating us to launching of the first satellite, Sputnik. And so there was a big move in the United States to try to build up our prowess in science and technology. And so a lot of conservative parents pushed their children to go into that. And that wasn't a major driver in mine, but I just know that part of the pride that my parents felt in what I was doing came from that kind of a mindset. So I started with a Viking Adventurer, a Johnson transmitter, single 807, CW only. I built a screen modulator for it that they also sold, plugged into the back. And I learned that you count the, you number the pins on a tube socket clockwise from below. Apparently I got mixed up and did it clockwise from above. As I dealt with that, turns out that that put the chassis of that thing at the plus volt. So that was my first big shock, literally. And so I was quite, you know, that made a big impression on me, and I've wound up learning how to count tubes and everything. I got to tell also, it's Vanderbilt, I mean, I'm sorry, Lipscomb University. Back then it was David Lipscomb College. My dad was the chairman of the department there. But there
I'm
was
sorry, the, you dropped out momentarily. Your dad was the chairman of
my
what?
My dad was the chairman of the Bible department there, and one of his good friends, who was pretty small faculty, so everybody knew everybody, was Dr. Everett Hunt, chairman of the physics department. And, of course, I was at that point, I think, 14, 15, but I had been fixing 5-tube AC-DC radios over at Fender State Sales, a little appliance store right across Granny White from the Lipscomb campus. And the physics department chairman said, well, would you like to come and work on some of our electronics? We can't pay you any money, but we'll swap you surplus equipment that we can't use for you maintaining the rest. And so, yeah, sure, I'd love to do that. So they had a bunch of Tektronix 511 AD scopes, I guess three or four of them, and one of them didn't have a case. It was just open. And he said, well, you'll fix these other three. I'll let you take that one home. And so, yes, I did it. And so at about 14, I was the first guy in my class to have his own professional oscilloscope. So that was good. And there's lots of opportunities like that. I'm just so grateful that I got into. They had a laser, one of the first argon lasers built in a very carefully polished glass tube about 5 feet long. And you had to excite it with RF up in the 30 megahertz range, and so the kit that you bought this with from wherever they bought it included a one of the Johnson CW transmitters, and so that connected to some aluminum foil on two different poles wrapped around that tube was the exciter to make it the laser. And of course I was already familiar with that kind of gear, so managed to get that working, and just a lot of fascinating things like that. One thing I never did really follow through on was they had a big rack that would have been perfect for building a really fine amplifier. And I had found a 4-1000 tube, I forget, somewhere. Maybe it came through them, I forget. But anyway, it was supposed to be in good condition. And they had a transformer that would have been good for the power supply. But I just never quite got all of it together and never built it. And frankly, I was kind of intimidated by it. But that was good. It was a dream that kept me motivated. For
Let me ask you this question. How much voltage could you have got B plus wise out of that transformer?
It was going to be around 3,800, I think. I mean, after rectification, it would be about a 3,000 to 3,800 volt DC power supply. That transformer could easily deliver an amp or an amp and a half.
Oh, the only reason I ask is not make you feel a little better. The 4-1000, if you don't get that plate voltage up to about 4,500 volts, they're just not very efficient at all. It takes so much drive to make one of those things go. But if you've got 4,500 volts on the plate, you know, it's a tetrode. You're running a grounded grid. It'll take off and go. But I've seen guys build little, like, screen supplies for them. You know, you put a little voltage on the screen, make them really go, you know. So, but anyways.
Well, I never quite followed through on that one. I was kind of intimidated, but, you know, next couple of years then at WSM, I got to play with everything. And, in fact, I got to the point where, today, I guess, I've got enough radio at the office, and it's only rarely that I sit down, but I would feel just naked here at the house if I didn't have an HF rig and didn't have some VHF equipment ready to go if somebody asked for a skid.
Well, you know, that's a common thing for you to feel like, you know, you're not dressed to go outside if you don't have an HF rig in the house.
That's right. I just don't have my legs, or I don't have my arms. It's just part of you.
Now, let me ask you this. In Tennessee, were you ever active or part of this Tennessee Teenage Net?
Yes, I was. And I think the statute of limitations is run now. So, but yes.
All teenage nets were crazy, so it's not like, you know. No, but this one here had some real key people in it.
Yes, it did. Actually, I remembered. It was a pretty well-balanced, homogeneous bunch of folks, but there were a whole bunch of colorful personalities in the whole thing. I think I was probably most active kind of on the technical side of things, and somebody would say, well, I'm having some trouble with this or that, and I would sit and theorize with them for a while about what it was and so on. So that was my main activity on it. We had several other people. I remember meeting a fellow who was a DJ up at WCUR in Lebanon, Tennessee on 900 kilohertz. His name was Terry Clymer, and I drove up to Lebanon one time to see him and meet him. He was on the air at the time and proudly showed me the, at that time it was a 500-watt station, I believe, but there was a 500-watt transmitter, and the studio looked pretty cool, and they were buying an FM and a lot of things like that. Terry was a very colorful character, and he used to mimic a fellow that he had heard on the air once, and we would always mimic him. There were several of them that he would mimic and kind of ridicule, and so that became kind of a social thing. He was kind of the entertainment of the Tennessee Teenage Net, and actually had his license suspended, I think, one time for deliberately interfering with some folks. But that was the level of teenage fun. It wasn't quite at the adult and more serious level of things, but that group had probably about 30 of us in it at one time or another, scattered all the way from middle of Illinois all the way down to across the top half of Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi. And I still remember several of those folks. I still got QSL cards and pictures. I remember one time we did some contest, actually in my upstairs apartment there at my home. I'm still a teenager. I guess I was 16 at that time. But a good time was had by all, as I guess I would say. And also a lot of radio was learned.
What frequency was the Tennessee Teenage Net on?
It was 7290.
So you were the 40-meter band.
Yeah, in the 40-meter band. Just 10 kilohertz inside the upper edge at that time of the 40-meter band. And it was a single sideband net. There'd be a couple of people who had AM still. But we'd meet in the afternoons, I think at 3 o'clock or 3:30 after people got out of school, and carry on until probably maybe 6 o'clock. And then, of course, there are a lot of good friendships between various ones in the net, and they, of course, go off to other frequencies. Also, during those years, the more official opportunity for, you know, for doing respected things in ham radio was the Tennessee single sideband net that met every evening on 3980. And I think that was 6:30 p.m., if I remember correctly, most nights. And there were some well-known hams across the whole Mid-South area. Otho Higley, WA4CGK, was probably one of the most prolific net control stations there. I remember 16, 17 years old, several times I got to call the net, and that's kind of a thrill. You know, that's a situation where there may be real traffic, and it may be very important, and also you've got to facilitate everybody getting together and having a good time, so that kind of helped wake me up. Never went to the broadcast side like you've been in for so long, but at least it got me to the point of being able to, you know, to understand moderating or working in a public environment and trying to maybe moderate a conversation between a lot of people in a way that gives everybody a chance to talk.
Yeah, you know, a net control, these fellows have to have the patience of Job, you know, because you've got all these guys checking in with their G5 RVs on 80 meters in the middle of a lightning storm running 100 watts, and you can't hear them, and you know, they expect you to be able to, because that's all you need is 100 watts in a thunderstorm and a G5 RV. I mean, you know.
Well, you can still get struck by lightning, but nobody can hear you while you're doing it. But I can remember many, many times somebody would call, and I'd say, repeat again, please, and then somebody would volunteer, or I'd ask, can I get a relay from anyone? And KL7WTW Mobile, located in Montana. Okay, well, I don't know what a KL7 is doing mobile in Montana, but I don't know. QRP Mobile would not be the favorite of a net control station.
I was going to say, well, you know, there was a TeenageNet, and I don't know what TeenageNet it was. I used to operate on 3968 on 80 meters that I used to hear all the time, but I can't remember who they were, what they were. But it was much like you were talking about, a lot of cutting up and having fun on the air. And, you know, you're going to have that with teenagers. I mean, they're going to get on there and, carry on and cut up and have fun. And I guess it kind of bothers me to think that some of the older hams would be so, I guess I want to say, so stodgy and curmudgeon-like to look down their noses, you know, and try to, I guess I want to say, criticize or... Like, you're going to round these young guys up and make citizens out of them, you know?
Well, we all know that approach doesn't work, but there was a great difference. The old people would say there's a great difference in maturity, and the young people would just say there's a great difference in focus. I can remember occasionally my parents would go to eat dinner with friends, and I would get to go along with them. And the worst possible thing that could happen to you would be to be stuck at the dinner table while the grown-ups were talking about stuff. And it wasn't interesting, and the conversation was so slow, and you couldn't interrupt because that would be impolite. And so you just had to sit there and just kind of suffer. And I think that kind of captures the dichotomy between those two groups. But
we do that to my grandson now, and he's sitting at the dinner table with us, and you know, he'll get up and he'll go through this little ritual. He'll go to each member sitting at the table and give him a hug and all that, you know, because he's fixing to hit the road and get upstairs on his computer, you know. So I let him go.
We're going to be voting for him one day. That's what it takes to be a good politician.
So anyways, well, I'll let him go through the whole process, and then he'll get halfway across the den, you know, and almost to the door, and I'll say, Brian, where are you going? just upstairs. I said, well, hey, what? You don't want to sit down and talk with all of us, you know, and be part of the conversation, you know?
Oh, you say this.
And he'll look at me and say, well, no, not really.
So, oh, my, an honest man.
So I it's really kind of funny that, but you know, when I was young, you didn't dream of getting up and leaving the table if adults were there and everybody was still eating, and you know, that you had to be excused. Somebody had to say, that's okay, you can run and do whatever, you know, but you didn't get up. And matter of fact, you didn't even ask to be excused, because that was as bad as leaving, you know. And that's a lost thing today, you know.
Yeah, it is. In fact, I think most people are able to continue their games on their smartphone or PDA or whatever, or any of the other gaming products. Not miss a single move in a whole dinner and still carry on a little bit of conversation with the family. So we've got multitasking kids with multiple processors today, and that's, I don't know if that's better or worse. I guess
I think it's bad news, and I think they're all ADD from it. You know, when we go on a trip, you know, I'll tell the kids in the back seat, I say, you know, the cell phones are away. You know, you're going to look out the window, okay? You're going to get some sense of where you are. You know, I remember making road trips every year from Michigan to Tennessee and back, you know, and I've got that whole route memorized in my head. I mean, I know exactly what I'm going to see going through Cincinnati and Louisville and all that, and Dayton, Ohio. But the kids today, they got their heads, I mean, for 8 solid hours, they're staring at a cell phone. And they never see a thing. No, I think that's all wrong. I think that's totally wrong. Nothing wrong with the cell phones. Nothing wrong with the games. But, you know, what about real life in real time? You know, can we do that for a little while? I mean, and I think that's something that we really need to kind of make it happen for them. You know, it's like, okay, collecting cell phones, you know, and we're going to put them away, you know. And you know, it's funny though, but once they sit there a little while and they start looking out the window, all of a sudden they don't miss the cell phone, and they're kind of caught up in all the stuff they're seeing, you know. So it's really kind of I don't know, that's a strange thing. I argue about it all the time, and I also think that kids spend way too much time in front of a computer screen. I think that you got to participate in life in real time, at least for a while, you know, or learn how to do it, you know. And so many, I think today are not acclimated that way. Okay, so what you were talking about, your first transmitter having an 807 in it and doing CW. When you first got into phone, what were you messing with then?
One of my dad's friends sold used hand equipment in Dallas, Texas, and I had been lobbying for a bigger transmitter. And he called one night from Texas. He was out here on business for a week and said, "Well, I found a Heathkit DX100. Is that a good one?" And not knowing anything but 100 watts must be good, I said, "Yes, I'll take it." And so, you know, he said, "Well, I'll see what it costs and see what we can do." And he did get it. And he had it brought home. He had one of his students, he was a professor at Lipscomb, and he had one of his students who lived in Dallas bring it home. I don't know what favors, maybe that was a letter grade or something at the class, but at any rate, he brought that, and I remember it arrived at our house in Nashville, and it was wedged down between his passenger seat and the driver's seat back, and I couldn't extract it. The thing weighed, you know, oh, I don't recall, 70 pounds or more, and so it took several of us to get it out, and then we got it into the house and put it on a table, and wow, that was, you know, that was the high point of my life, at least to that point. And then I worked on it. The DX100's had a problem. In the driver at 5763, there was a 27K, I believe it was, half-watt screen resistor. But there were many conditions you could tune into with that transmitter and not know you were doing anything unusual, where that thing would dissipate 2 or 3 watts. And so I learned pretty soon that I'd be transmitting on that AM transmitter, and I'd make a good, you know, 5 or 6 minute transmission. And then, George, over to you, W5-something-something. This is WA4BXI. And when I would turn the plate switch off, there'd be somebody already in the middle of their transmission. And I would come back, and or people would say, "I don't know what happened to Scott. He just drifted out of there." And so I finally realized, and then started watching the meters while I was talking, and yeah, it would just, the drive would just go away. So it took me a summer to find out what was really going on in that. And for an 11-year-old, 12-year-old to do that with a VOM and just trying to figure it out was really great education. So that was my first AM transmitter.
What did you figure out the problem to be?
It was the screen resistor of the 5763 RF driver stage way over dissipating. It needed to be at least a 2-watt resistor, but Heathkit had designed it and used a 0.5-watt. And there wasn't any kind of a note or an addendum or anything about that. There may have been something released, but it never reached me and was never publicly known by any of the people I asked about. And so, ultimately, I just figured that out. So it was a design error. And that was pretty impressive to me that, you know, there could be design errors that you have to find in commercial equipment, that it's not all just perfect and, you know, right out of the factory. I had another experience. You know, you're mentioning the kind of lamenting how we've so attached ourselves to computing devices, even at the dinner table. I was out, I learned about repeaters when I was 16 and started working on repeaters. We finally got a repeater on 146.04 input, 146.64 output, and it became kind of a Tennessee Teenage Net repeater. And I put an auto patch on it. This is way, way back early. I guess it would have been 66. And so we had Dickie Harris at Electra may have had an auto patch earlier on a 2-meter system he had. But wires was the first that I was aware of. And anyway, I would go driving around just to document the repeater's coverage. And, being able to make a phone call from the car, people would say, "Wow, man, you got a phone in your car. What a great way to pick up chicks." And my reaction to that would have been, "Chicks? Who wants chicks? I want to check all of Simpson County and Trigg County, Kentucky this evening on one big drive around, see how far I can, you know, what the coverage of the repeater is and how far I can hit it. And if we had girls on board, they just want to be stopping at every McDonald's and going to the bathroom and all that kind of stuff. They're bad news, man. Just stay away from them. And that, that viewpoint continued up until late in high school and then finally going through Vanderbilt. And so I do have three children now, all of them grown, and I learned about all of those things. The only white powders I ever learned about were salt and sugar, although some of my friends tried some of the other things that I'm told are available. And I don't know, it was a good time. Ham radio kept me focused on things that actually did ultimately in the end, you know, kind of contribute to the overall progress of life. But I also understand people are driven by what they're interested in. And you can't motivate somebody by criticizing them. That just doesn't work. And so it's really all a matter of enjoying life, enjoying the people you're with, and kind of nudging them on, supporting them, giving them opportunities. And as I look back, although all of us have a lot of complaints about our parents, as I look back, my parents actually laid out some opportunities for me that I couldn't have done if I just had to buy it myself. I also remember seeing my dad up in a tree at about 40 feet above the ground helping me string a 40-meter dipole and realizing that if he falls, our family is bankrupt and we'll all be paupers. And that taught me a couple of things. First, it made me fearful of putting people in really, really bad, risky positions. And secondly, it let me realize that I had the ability to manage people somewhat. If you can get your parents, you know, you're supposed to work for your bosses. You're supposed to work for your parents. And I've seen some, you know, there's some humorous stuff out in the management realm of people saying, manage your boss effectively and so on. But there I was managing my father effectively and just thinking, oh, my God, you know, I've gone too far with this. I can't think of what would happen if he fell. So let's get him down out of the tree. But not after, not until he's strung the dipole, though. You got to have first.
Well, now let me ask you this question. We've heard about AM. Now, I've got a Heathkit DX100 here, and I haven't fooled with it very much, but I've also got a Viking, I believe it's a Viking 2 with the separate VFO. I was, at some point in time, you know, I was going to get on AM, and then we acquired a McMartin kilowatt AM transmitter, and then we decided that, well, we'll put that on AM, you know, but none of it's got done. And then when we had the flood, we grabbed that McMartin and took it down to the river and hooked it up to get WIFN, which is the old WSIX, get it back on the air because it was totally underwater. And it was. So anyways, we ran that down there for them. That's normally a 5-kilowatt station. But then we used the Yaesu 757 is the oscillator because I couldn't find, we obviously couldn't get a crystal on short notice. So that thing worked pretty good. It really did. It worked very, it was surprising. But how did you transition now? See, you're an AM guy and now you've got to transition to slop bucket. Now how did you do that?
Well, actually, for pretty easy, one or the other lost one, or maybe the three or four one, and there was some real work in Iowa.
So, yes, I then finally I had been drooling, of course, over the Collins S line. Wow, 75S1 and a 32S1, and either their tabletop amplifier, I forget the model on it, but the 30L1, the big floor mounted amplifier. Wow, I wish I had one of those, but. No, those were only affordable by successful professionals, and I was not one yet at the age of 14, 15, 16. But working at WSM from 16 on, I had enough money to buy the Heathkit S-series, or S-line as some people call it. So I had an SB300 receiver. Before the SB301 came along, that first generation SB300, and that worked great, and I enjoyed it a lot. And then built the SB200. I finally had an SB300, SB200, and an SB400. The 200, I guess, would be the amplifier, and the 400 was the transmitter, if I'm remembering correctly. But those worked very well. They gave good performance, almost as good as the Collins. And so that was my mainstay radio through most of my junior high and high school years. And I also tried, I had a Sunbed Engineers SBE-33, which I used mobile for a long time. Later got an SBE-34 and played with it for a while. Had an NCX-3 transceiver and an NCX-5 transceiver. What else did I have? Way back in the beginning, I had an 8th kit Sixer and had some happy times on that with a separated zip cord antenna. Hung, you know, basically just at head level in the front yard to communicate. That was really pretty cool.
Well, for all those folks that may still, I've got an SBE-34 on the shelf. It's terrible.
Yeah, that's a good place for them.
Okay, tell me about that rig. You ran it mobile. How did it do, or what was it?
33 first. And I updated to the 34, but I just didn't really, didn't notice a lot of difference, and finally just wanted more power. I was using it at home too, so. But I found the 33 to work very well. I had a little bit of problem with drift, but part of that was bad regulation in the power supply, and also somebody had an article about how to correct the temperature compensate that VFO, so I did some of that, and that seemed to take care of the drift problem. But
well, I built a kit. I built an ICO 753. And I did everything under the sun and could not get rid of the drift. And I was trying to find somebody that could practice voodoo, maybe that could cure the drift on that rig. I don't know if you ever saw one of those. They were cool. They were a cool radio. They just drifted like crazy, you know. And but I learned to just keep my hand on the PTO and just kind of, you know. I had actually entertained the thought. I said, I wonder if you couldn't put a clock drive on there like they do with telescopes, you know. And adjust the drift out of it, you know. But
remember the Cubans back in those days? They all had real bad AC hum, and they all were drifting all over the place. You just drift up the band. But
what were they? I wonder what were they running?
Well, they were typically running, I guess half of it was homebrew equipment. They're just reading some accounts these days. And a lot of it was some of the older vintage tube type stuff that we had, you know, old Hallicrafters S640 or S40s, whatever the old receivers were. And transmitters were easier to build than receivers for a lot of them. So, but they notoriously always had bad filter capacitors. And also, in a lot of places, the power network was very, very flimsy, and, you know, your line voltage would sag as you keyed your transmitter if it was 100 watts or more. And so they were kind of notorious as the worst signals that you'd hear on the dial. So, of course, some people were politically opposed to listening to them and kind of denigrated all of them because of that. But I think they were pioneers, you know. You can see it in the automobiles, you know. Back in the 60s, they had more 1953 Fords running than probably any other country in the world. And people don't have much managed to do what they can with the foot they got.
Group of fellas that we used to operate CW when we were young, and we would mess around with a homebrew transmitter until we could get it chirping. That was the big thing, is we wanted to create the biggest chirp. And then sit back and wait for someone to say something about it, you know. What makes somebody want to do something like that? I don't know. But you know what? Here's what I do. I mean, and I'll confess this on the QSO radio show. I'll get on to
the statute of limitations is important. Is this old enough you're not going to get prosecuted?
I like to get on and be in the middle of a QSO, you know, and, you know, most of the people are half listening, you know, so you get two or three new guys get on and on 2 meters, you know, and then all of a sudden I'll say to my son, or one of them say Matt or David, well, I'll say David, yeah, how hard is it to pass the test to get the license to operate one of these radios? That brings them all out of the woodwork. Boy, I'll tell you what, man, I've been told off and read the Riot Act and everything else, you know, and we're sitting there just laughing away, you know. There was another guy that I knew crazy fella, just absolutely crazy as a Betsy bug. And he could do this duck voice. He could talk just like a duck, you know. And so we were talking back and forth, and I said, well, you know, if you sign your call sign in your regular voice, you can come back in that duck voice. I mean, there's no stipulation with a commission that says you can't use a duck voice, okay? And
as long as it's not singing.
Yeah, he was, you know, he was this third party. I mean, he'd get on with his call sign, and he would have a conversation with a duck just like Paul Winchell would with Jerry Mahoney, you know. And I'm telling you what, I mean, it drove people crazy. It just really, really did. But that, see, that's something I really think. Now, you tell me if I'm wrong. I think that one thing that's missing today, big time, on ham radio is the fun portion of it that we experienced when we were younger. I just don't think that that's elements missing. It's just a little bit too serious, you know. I mean, I tell this story all the time. We got one guy here in town, and we had some blind kids from the blind school up on the 440 machines, and he came in there. Ah, you can't be talking on here. The weather service is listening, and they don't want to hear all your, you know, and not a cloud in the sky. You know, and I was like, tell the weather service to turn the radio off. Let the blind kids talk, okay? What's going on here? I mean, you know, it's just ham radio, you know? And, of course, during emergency, I said something the other night, and it's stuck in my own head. Have you ever said something that's stuck in your head?
Yes, I have.
You know, and not being egotistical about it, but I was talking about how wonderful the ham radio hobby is and how we're able to respond to things like in emergencies. And I said, it sure beats the daylights out of stamp collecting, you know. And then I said, you know, when a tornado blows through or a hurricane comes through, how many people out there, once all the communications are down, are out going, hey, you know what? We got to find a stamp collector. You know? It's not happening.
I need to preface this by saying this is no criticism of stamp collectors.
I have a lot of friends that do stamp collecting, and they collect all kinds of things, you know, and that's all cool. Coin collectors. There's another group of people that, you know, that are really into a hobby of coin collecting, you know. But I see, you
not
know,
much help in a hurricane.
Yeah. But for us, we just can't do that. You know, we collect boat anchors, you know, and things that when you turn them on smell like tubes. Okay.
That's right.
And we're the ones that walk around the Dayton Hamvention, you know, just frustrated because it would take about $5,000 in order to be able to pick up all the stuff we see that we really, really need. You know what I mean?
Yes, not to even include the things that you just want.
So,
I mean, that would drive it into the millions.
Well, you know, there was a big war between sideband and AM. In other words, it was just very heated type contest, weren't you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Do you remember much of that? Were you involved in any of it at all?
I was kind of a bystander. I was just getting into phone at the time. That was already a mature thing. And, of course, going from that first generation of single sideband equipment where most of it was, you know, balanced modulators and stuff like that and was very critical to adjust and performance wasn't real good. People used to call them sidewinders, and I don't want anything to do with those sidewinders. It's admittedly, AM is much richer and than good. There were a couple of folks, I think, still around who were active in one side or the other of those wars. It was generally the more technically progressive hams who were eager to use single sideband, and it was the older guys who just felt that the rich, mellow sound of AM was really God's gift to radio. And so the two were difficult. There was a fellow, I never talked to him, but one of the Tennessee TeenageNet hams was constantly, mimicking and laughing at him. K4KYV at Woodlawn, Tennessee. And he was really one of the best examples and best practitioners of big transmitters on AM. I've heard secondhand stories of his having an actual pole transformer sitting there in the room with him and running HV lines around taped to soft drink bottles empty sitting on the floor.
I think I visited with that guy. He's still around, isn't he?
I think he is.
He had his whole station like in an old schoolhouse out there in Woodlawn.
I've never visited it, but I heard legends, just all kinds of legends about him, and I would love to see his place there because I know that he had a remarkable collection of stuff. It was high power, and when he transmitted on 75 meters, he was the signal on top of everything else, and he got through very well.
Well, we stopped by there, and if it's the same fella, he has a pretty good-sized tower in the backyard, which he has, you know, tuned for like a vertical on 80, uh-huh. And I believe 40. But we went in, and he did. He had a couple of broadcast transmitters in that it was a schoolhouse, and he moved it over onto his property. And we just stopped and knocked on the door, and he was like, well, come on in, and gave us a tour. I mean, it was wonderful. I'm telling you, if there's a way that you have the time to go by there, I would definitely go by and pay that fellow a visit. He was very friendly, and the shack was absolutely the most impressive radio, amateur radio facility I've ever seen, period. I mean, and well cared for as well. An exemplary fella, I'm telling you that. But anyways, go ahead. I mean, you were getting into that. I was going to say, I had an old HT-37 and an SX-101 with the HT-37 was a phasing sideband transmitter, but boy, it had clean, impeccable audio. And I also, when I first started out, I had a Globe Champ 300, which ran a pair of 9909s in the final. It was plate modulated. Well, I'd love to have that thing back today. But I remember hearing these but fights on the air over sideband versus AM. And I just wondered how much of that you were exposed to or got, you know, either got caught in the middle of or remember.
I think that war was pretty much resolving in favor of single sideband by the time that I first got my General. That was in 1966, I guess. And I think most of those battles happened in the early 60s, late 50s, early 60s, as single sideband just first came along. It was a curiosity, and then people began to, you know, to understand that you can have communications in about half the spectrum that you take up when you're AM. And so that gave kind of the sideband folks kind of who had already an advanced opinion of the technology, gave them more of a righteous reason for doing it, and they began to look down on the AMers, and the AMers felt basically that here's this new, more righteous than now bunch that's disparaging us for this beautiful thing that we've been using all these years that works so well. And so, you know, it was a major argument. But in the end, I guess for me, I was attracted more by the advanced argument. And look at how cool this really is, and look at how little spectrum you're using and all that. And so ultimately, by the time I got into it, that was what I was interested in. My first couple of transmitters, voice transmitters, were AM. Put that screen modulator on the Johnson Viking Adventurer. And of course, it did not have a VFO, so I had to use crystals. I remember I had one for, I guess, 7275 and another one for 7230 something, and I recall, but only about three or four frequencies I could use, and then also some favorite crystals down in the CW band. But so it was time to move to a VFO, and that's when the Heathkit DX100 was such a cool thing, and I enjoyed that for several years. And then finally, it had a VFO, of course, but it wasn't real accurately calibrated. You couldn't tell where you were within, you know, any better than maybe 2 or 3 or 4 kilohertz at best. And up on the high bands, up on, say, 10 meters, you didn't know where you were within 30 or 40 kilohertz. So I was ready for something different. And going to that Heathkit S line was just wonderful. You could, you had repeatability of a couple of hundred hertz on frequencies from day to day. And that was just really, really cool. So the war was over by that time. Everybody had single sideband. AM was still available on those radios, but the peak envelope power for the AM signal was still about the same as the PEP for sideband. And of course, the peak envelope power in AM signal is 4 times the carrier power. So if you had a 100-watt transmitter, and you're using it on an AM, it's a linear device phasing down at the lower levels, you can't really run more than about a 25-watt carrier before you're then going to be overdriving it. So things were more effective on single sideband. And so that's just kind of my take on it. Never worked in the military and had any exposure to high-power single sideband transmitters, but basically it was pretty well understood that a 10 or 12 kilowatt single sideband transmitter could do as good a job of communicating as a 50 kilowatt AM transmitter. So that's the factor that kind of won me over in the end. It's just so much more efficient.
Well, you know, I was going to say, today, though, what's kind of interesting is the fellows that are doing AM today. You know, I heard a guy on the air who had built his own PDM AM transmitter.
Wow.
And his audio was incredible. So what you've got now is the technical pool. You know, I used to be that I could get on, and ask a question about anything. You could come on and ask a question about a recording hit on a tape recorder. You'd say, you know, I got this happening or that happening, or, you know, how can I tell if I've got the azimuth lined up or whatever? And there'd be some guy who'd come back that would know exactly what you're talking about and would give you an answer, you know. You could ask a question about, push to talk relay inside of a transceiver, some distortion you're having on right channel on your stereo amplifier. I don't care what it was. You know, they'd come back and they'd tell you. I remember one time I had an AA100 Heathkit stereo amp, and I went on and I said, if something's wrong, here's what's happening. This fella come back and told me exactly what to do and where to look. Today, it's not like that. I mean, today, it's like you ask a technical question, and a lot of the round tables that are on, or you jump in somewhere, try to find somebody who knows something, and you're going to look for a needle in a haystack because they're just not out there. But on the AM side, the guys that are operating AM, they seem to be the ones now that have all the technical prowess. Or have you noticed that?
No, I have. And, you know, it's like we see in some other industries. These days, in order to do good AM and to do some kind of pulse width modulated, basically variable modulator, not have to have a modulation transformer or modulation reactor or anything like that, do it entirely digitally, that's terrific. And what we're seeing really is kind of a reverse nostalgic return to the AM by the people who can afford to do it, and what they're doing is really showing you what it would be if we'd continued it. And you know, the broadcast side of things, people just didn't build big plate modulated transmitters after somewhere in the early to mid 60s. I remember in RCA's advertising magazine they put out each month, WBAL in Baltimore got one of RCA's Ampliphase transmitters. It's basically a phase modulated screen, a scheme where you have two channels from the exciter all the way up to power amplifiers, and there's a little bit of amplitude modulation done, but most of the change comes as the phase between the two channels is swung back and forth. When they're in phase, you get very high output. When they're out of phase, they cancel, and you get almost to 100% negative troughs. And so, really impressive. Now, that was popular in the broadcast industry because you didn't have to have a modulation transformer, modulation reactor, no really big energy-storing components at audio frequencies, just a big DC power supply to run the whole thing. And then, of course, I guess it was Harris that I remember first that came along with their pulse-width modulated transmitters and doing things in kind of a multi-phase circuit so that you never had very big resistive losses. And that became popular. But at the same time, hams just weren't really following that trend. So what we're seeing now, I think, is some of the more advanced modulation techniques from the commercial broadcasting world, both medium waves and HF2, getting reapplied and kind of individually re-engineered back for the ham world. And frankly, that has a lot of appeal for me. That's if I didn't have to work for a living and didn't have other interesting things to do, that's the kind of project that I would spend all my time puttering around with, and I'd be so proud when I got it good. I'd measure the harmonic distortion, and basically that thing would be perfect.
Well, I'd be hanging out with you then. I'd be hanging out with you, picking your brain there.
Well, we'd have some fun. I know that.
Well, you know, somewhere along the line, there was a fellow on the air one day on AM talking, and I'd flip my rig over to the AM mode, and I would think, well, I hope not. You know, you kind of feel like you're jumping in, and you just hope nobody realizes you don't have any clothes on. When you're running one of these, but oddly enough, some of the rigs do pretty fair on AM. Some of the newer rigs, I mean, at least it's acceptable. But it seemed like I was running the Drake TR4C or something, and I jumped in, and I don't know what kind of arrangement they do on that thing to, I would say, simulate AM. But I started talking to this guy, and he said, "Oh, well, I've got here," and he starts telling what he's running. And I can't remember what tubes he had in this thing. It seems like he was running 4-400s, but he was talking about Doherty. He said, "I'm running Doherty modulation here." And wow. I thought, well, now I remember seeing some AM broadcast transmitters with Doherty modulation, and they were weird. I mean, you know, if you didn't know what they were, it'd really throw you off. You'd look at it and you'd say, "What is this?" You know?
Yeah. How do you do? What? How can this do any AM?
Yeah. But this guy had built one out of tubes and was on the air with it, and it really sounded nice. It really sounded sweet. Now, I'm just wondering, now, I don't know, maybe you're the fellow to ask, what was the claim to fame for the Doherty modulation scheme?
Well, Doherty and Ampliphase were kind of in the same area. They were basically schemes for doing AM modulation faithfully, but without having to have any big transformers or modulation reactors or anything. Now, the Ampliphase basically had an exciter, and then the modulator actually was a phase modulator that took two outputs from the exciter and shifted them back and forth in phase so that they would combine effectively in phase or destroy themselves out of phase, and everywhere in between. It was very smooth. They had to do some amplitude correction in the last amplifier or two in order to make it linear, but that worked. The Doherty worked a little differently. Basically, with the Doherty, you have two tubes in the PA, and the interesting thing is, you don't want to run and have heavy resistive losses because you've got big DC current flowing in the tubes all the time. So what they do in order to avoid that is to kind of let the two tubes work in stages. The lower tube, some people call it the carrier tube, actually operates when there's no modulation. It is running at full power and producing the power output of the transmitter, and it runs in pretty much a linear mode. The low carrier, as you reduce the drive, it goes down essentially to zero. Now, that tube's output is connected through a 90-degree phase shift network, and the peak tube, as it's called, which handles the higher power modulation peaks, is also driven. And what happens as the peak tube begins to conduct, there's an impedance transformation across this 90-degree phase network between it and the carrier tube, and both of them deliver more power into the load. So it's a pretty elaborate thing. Actually, there was a Dr. Weldon, as well as Doherty, who both collaborated in various variations of that. Continental Electronics, manufacturer of the Continental series of AM transmitters for broadcast, has used the Weldon grounded grid circuit for a lot of years. I don't know what the current latest products of theirs are, but they were Doherty. Some people think Doherty's were a little bit easier to operate and to adjust. The Ampliphases weren't quite as linear and took a lot of special careful babying to make them work. But one thing I was just shocked at the other day, I was out in Texas and was doing a class at Nokia, which makes not only phones but also makes cellular transmitters and base stations. And in the course of doing some research for a class I was doing out there with them, I discovered that in solid-state circuitry for modern Wi-Fi hubs and wireless devices of all types, the Doherty amplifier has come back. And so if you go out and buy an 802.11 Wi-Fi device for your home, a router and hub, there's a very good chance that the power amplifier in that uses two transistors, and it's basically the old Doherty circuit. It's more efficient, and you know, just producing that much less heat makes it popular. And so I thought that that was something, you know, I thought that was an antique. I thought that was like a Model T Ford. You're never going to see one except in a museum. But to see them now put together and actually use it, that's on the cutting edge again. Isn't that incredible how things come around again?
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know what? You know, we've been talking away here, and we've talked about ham radio. We've talked about a broadcast, and we're going to have you back so that you can get into cellular and all the things that you're doing now, because we're still not finished with the radio part, see? So and we're going to run out of time pretty soon. But I was going to ask you now, when you went into broadcast engineering, what were the, I mean, I guess when you were obviously working at WSM, but what, name some other stations or some other things you were involved in the broadcasting industry.
Well, my first real job was at WSM, and that was a great place to kind of come under the wing of a lot of people. But what drove me to a lot of other places, a lot of other opportunities, was that most of the guys at the WSM transmitter were, you know, old, mature, and had families. And the last thing in the world they wanted to do was stand in a cornfield in Smithville, Tennessee, in the middle of the night and make an impedance measurement on an AM station or do a proof of performance for somebody and then come back home in the wee hours of the morning and crawl into bed and have to get up the next morning at 7 o'clock. Well, for me, that sounded wonderful. And so basically at the transmitter, anytime something like that came, and of course people in the smaller stations naturally look to wherever they can find somebody to solve their more difficult problems, and the big stations typically get a lot of those calls. And all of those, you know, WSM area pretty much got dumped on me by the WSM engineers who really would rather not do it. And so that was great for me. I found all of those to be tremendous adventures. And, you know, I'll drive up to Smithville and stand in the cornfield till 6 the next morning and fix everything. And I'll charge them $20 for coming up and $5 for the gas. So, you know, that's by today's standards. Wow, that's incredible, man. You can't get an over-the-phone estimate for $25. But that was great. I learned also how not to upset people. You know, when the morning DJ has been working on it for 3 days and can't get it back on the air, you certainly don't come in and brag about how you found it. You come in and involve him in the process and let him be the one who actually decides, well, that's probably it. Let's try it. So it taught me a lot of things. I'm so grateful that that all came together that way.
Well, yeah, and today, of course, a lot of small stations don't have full-time engineers. They still depend on contract engineers or somebody to come in. And most generally, those guys are working full-time jobs. And, of course, as they get up in years, they're not excited about going out in the cornfield there. You know, plus, you know, today, a lot of the smaller AM stations, you may wait a while before you get payment for the work that you've done if you're a broadcast engineer. And I heard a story told. I don't know if you ever heard of this, where these guys would take mothballs. Have you ever heard of this? And and put them in the interlock of the transmitter, and they would submit their bill, and they would wait for the mothballs, of course, will evaporate. And in time, what happens, give it a month or so, or however long it takes, those mothballs evaporate, the interlock, you know, switch, you know, moves, and the transmitter goes off. And that was the way they would make payment. They'd get payment because then they'd call and say, hey, we're off the air. And the engineer would say, well, you know, if you can take care of this little bill from the last visit I made, I'd be happy to come out and work with you. Have you ever heard of this before?
No, I haven't. But I think that those are necessary methods for some of the guys these days. Many of the little stations barely had money for the owner to make his house payment. And then, of course, you've got to pay the power at the transmitter. And then, of course, you've got to pay the morning man or else do it all yourself. And the consultant who helped you or the maintenance engineer who helped you is just kind of way down on that list. And that's actually what drove me into the cellular industry instead of broadcast. You could bill a very comfortable living, and 3 months later, you've collected about a third of it. And I didn't want to do that. Speaking in Star Trek terms, I wanted to put most of my energy into propulsion and only maybe 10% in the shields. But in broadcast consulting, it got to the point where you had to spend more energy collecting and cajoling and begging and so on than you did actually solving the problems. And that's, you know, that's an indication of an industry that's having real big troubles and you might be better off doing something else. But it sure felt like a a big step backwards, going from doing broadcast consulting and directional antenna tuning and all those enjoyable things to suddenly now being a, you know, just a member of a technical staff of a big cellular company. But I discovered that the cellular paychecks were always good. And the broadcasters, you always went to the bank on the way out of town. And oftentimes the story was, oh, Mr. Bester, I'm so sorry. They're not sufficient funds. And this broadcaster would tell you, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't know we were going to cash it right now, but we should have a check-in either tomorrow or the next day, and it'll be good at that point. So we really appreciate your patience. So,
and you, of course, inside you're saying, I don't have any patience.
Well, bottom line, I enjoy it so much. Basically, I should have told people that I will work on your transmitter for food.
We'll work so for food, yeah. Well, yeah, and that is one thing I will say about radio engineering, and that is it is extremely fascinating. It's fun, and it is also a captivating experience,
yeah,
when you're working and you're
satisfying.
You're troubleshooting. You know, you go in and, you know, you look at this thing, it's off the air, and you say, all right, now what could it be this time? You know, and you start poking around and poking around, and sometimes. Sometimes it doesn't come real fast. I had to laugh. It was a story told by Watt Harrison. I guess he was at LAC, and the thing had been off the air, and he'd been on the phone with Harris for hours, and they didn't have any idea what it was, and you know, and he didn't know what it was, and they finally said, "Well, whenever you figure it out, call us back and tell us." Now that's the tech support guy, you know. So he said he went out and sat out on the front porch, and he was thinking to himself, he says, the people that own this place, I wonder what's going to happen when they figure out I don't know what I'm doing. You know, anyway, of course, well, it isn't that he didn't know what he was doing. We've all been there. We have all been at the transmitter site when the thing is down, and we've tried everything we know. We've had the print. We've followed everything, you know, down a logical path. All the voltages are present, or maybe some aren't, but we can't figure out why. You know, you're looking in the power supply. All diodes are good. Caps are okay. You know, but you still haven't got voltage at some point. You know, and you're just frustrated. And then, of course, you know, you'll sit down and drink a cup of coffee and relax for a few minutes. And you go back and go, ah, look at this. You know, something you missed. You know, and I think we've all been there. And at that point in time, we all think to ourselves, I don't really know what the heck I'm doing. Have you ever been there?
Yeah, you know, it teaches you humility. And everybody has been stumped. And it's especially gives you humility when somebody else comes in and just immediately says, oh, well, you know, it's probably this. And you say, darn, I wish I'd thought of that. So, I don't know. I found that two things, you know, we're at our best when we're kind of playing at something we really like. And if you are afraid because there's a gun to your head that you have to have it working, and you're thinking moment by moment about how bad this outage is becoming, it's been 14 minutes now, it's been 15 minutes now, it's been 16 minutes now, that basically kills all your independent train of thought, and you can't really do much very well. So it's kind of mind over matter, I guess. Somebody who can manage to be detached and objective, and kind of take a, you know, observer's look at it and say, wow, you know, we've been off the air for a while now. Wonder what it could be. It keeps that kind of thing, doesn't get under the pressure. But that's not the way I've always done it.
Well, you know, when
we're off the air.
A lot of the times the program director calls, can you give me a timeline? I don't even know what it is. What do you mean a timeline, you know? And then the owner calls, well, what could it be? Well, if I knew what it was, I'd have it fixed, you know? So I had the guy from WABC in New York, one of the engineers there, I was told that when the phone would ring, he'd pick it up and he would say, talk or fix? And I thought that was good. I was really, really impressed. You know what? We're out of time. We're out of time. And we haven't even got to the good stuff yet. So
well, let's do it again.
I really, Scott Baxter, N4SB. Boy, I really appreciate you coming on board. And I know folks are going to really enjoy listening to the stories you told and experiences and as you relate your ham radio as well as professional career to everyone. But yes, you have to come back, and we're going to have to do this again because there's just so much more territory we can cover.
Well, so much fun doing it, and I know that a lot of folks, I wish everybody could join in with this too, because there are a lot of fascinating stories, fascinating experiences out there. Look forward to doing it again.
That's all the time we've got for QSO today. Want to say thank you for listening. Be sure and join us again next week, same time, same station. Our guest, Scott Baxter, N4SB. We want to say thank you to Scott for joining us this week. And to all 73s from QSO. Here at the QSO Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website, simply QSORadioShow.com. That's QSORadioShow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there and other information. But go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win. Because always giving something away. Go to the website. It's simply QSORadioShow.com and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening.